Gospel according to John.
Glory to you, O Lord.
On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now standing there were 6 stone jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. He said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the chief steward." So they took it. When the steward tasted the water that had become wine, and he did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you have kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this, the first of his signs in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. The Gospel of Christ. Please be seated. The Gospel of John is by far my favorite of the 4 Gospels. And maybe it's my Irish heritage, but I just love a good story, and the more outrageous, the better. The Irish have never been known to let the facts get in the way of a good story. And the Gospel of John is full of really good stories. It was the last of the 4 Gospels to be written, and it nearly didn't make it into the biblical canon because the religious powers that be cited all sorts of problems with this particular portrait of Jesus. Not the least of which are all the signs and wonders that Jesus commands in this gospel. So just for the record, let me say that I don't believe that this particular story happened exactly the way that it is written. I don't believe that the man, Jesus of Nazareth, had the ability to instantaneously change water into wine. I do believe that getting hung up on whether or not Jesus could actually work miracles is to miss the point of this story altogether. So this morning, rather than go into a long and drawn-out explanation of the historical critical method of studying the scriptures in order to explain why the writer of the Gospel of John wrote this particular story, or to speculate upon the particular theological points the author was trying to make to his second century audience, I would like to set the history aside for a moment and look at what the author might have been trying to inspire in the people who would hear or read his story about the wedding in Cana. To do that, I want to get at the very heart of this story to explore what it might be like for the people who actually encountered the man, Jesus of Nazareth. I mean, on the surface of it, this story is about a kind of intoxication that happened to people who came into the presence of this strange man from Nazareth. The best way I know of interpreting a story is to lay down another story right beside it and let the one story interpret the other. So, once upon a time, I remember it well. It was a damp and very dreary day in Vancouver. It stood out from all the other damp and dreary days. It was in the middle of February, and we've been getting a bit of a taste of that here in January, what a Vancouver February is like. Dull, dark, and dreary, and very, very damp. Anyway, on this particular day in Vancouver, it had been overcast and raining for weeks and weeks and weeks. and I was riding on the bus to work. It was the same bus that I'd been riding on for 2 years. Every weekday morning, I would commute by bus from the suburbs to the heart of the city. Every morning at 6:15, I would stand with the very same people at the same bus stop, and we would get on the same bus, which carried all the same people to the same jobs every day. On a good day, the trip would take about 45 minutes. And nobody ever spoke to anybody during the course of that 45 minutes. Occasionally, people would nod or smile at the all-too-familiar faces of their traveling companions, but conversation would be reserved for sunny days, when people could manage a word or two in the morning. It was like there was this unwritten rule that nobody had the energy or the inclination to break. We saw one another almost every day, and yet we knew absolutely nothing about one another. And that was the way we were determined to keep it. Well, on this particular February morning, in addition to being tired, I was also very wet. The wind was really blowing, and I had to rely on my hooded jacket to keep me dry. Now, that may not sound like much to you, but in Vancouver, you never go anywhere without an umbrella. And hooded jackets won't keep you dry for very long. The bus was running late, and the water was just beginning to seep through my jacket. When I got on the bus, I sat in my usual seat, and I ignored the damp as best as I could. And I did what I did most mornings. I tried to take a short nap before we got to the city. And I was just beginning to doze off when the bus screeched to a halt and several passengers climbed aboard. All but one of them I recognized. I'd seen them hundreds of times before. But there was this young man who got on the bus that I had never seen before, and he loudly greeted the bus driver. I mean, he said good morning to the bus driver. He struggled to fold his broken umbrella, and as he stumbled to the rear of the bus, I was horrified because he decided to sit opposite me. And then he did the unthinkable. He proceeded to greet everyone around us. Well, some of us just nodded and looked away. I mean, who was this guy who was talking to us in the morning? Some people are kinder than I am, and they mumbled a greeting before fixing their gaze out the window. I had just smiled and nodded, and then I decided the best defense was to just close my eyes and pretend I was sleeping. Well, the young man continued to fuss with this umbrella. And then he explained in a loud voice that the umbrella was a gift from his sister, like we cared. And he hoped that he hadn't ruined this umbrella. And then he asked the gentleman across the aisle if he would help him fold this umbrella. Well, the gentleman was like in shock and kind of flustered. And he took the umbrella and he folded it without saying a word. And when he'd completed his task, the young man thanked the gentleman profusely. And then he said, "What is your name?" He said, "I want to be able to tell my sister who the nice man was who helped me with my umbrella." Well, without revealing his name, the gentleman assured the young man that it wasn't necessary to thank him. The young man, on the other hand, proceeded to break all the rules and said that his name was Michael. And he told us all that he had never ridden on this bus before. He told us that he usually had to get the bus that went before us. But he changed jobs. And now he was going to work at a different time. And his sister was going to pick him up. We were getting details, like details and details. Anyway, on this day, he was going to begin his new job. It was going to be his first full day of work. And so this was the first time he'd ever caught the bus in the dark. And then he went on to tell us that the bus we were riding on was a much nicer bus than the one he'd ever had to catch before, and you know, when he went to his other job. This is a deluxe bus that we were riding on. He decided that this bus must be new. And weren't we all so very lucky to get to ride on this new bus? And then Michael took off his hat and he held it out in front of him so we could all see it. And he declared that he is the luckiest person in the world because his mother had bought him this wonderful hat to keep his hair dry. Michael went on to tell us all sorts of details about his life. And at first, people managed to listen without responding. But as Michael went on describing his wonderful life, people found that in spite of themselves, they were drawn into conversation. And as we approached the tunnel that goes under the Fraser River that normally causes traffic to back up at rush hour, it was clear that there must have been some sort of accident in the tunnel. Now, this usually meant that it would be a very, very long ride into town. What it meant on that particular morning, that there was no way that we were going to escape Michael's enthusiasm. Before long, we all knew that Michael was going to work in the mailroom of a securities company. And he assured us that this security company was a safe place to work because they didn't really take care of security. They weren't involved in keeping people safe. They just had to take care of pieces of paper that were called stocks and bonds. Michael told us just how much he was going to love this job. Having a job was the best thing that could ever happen to him. Before he had a job, he didn't have any money, but he'd been there training for 6 weeks. And imagine this, they were teaching him how to work and they were paying him half his salary, but it was more money than he'd ever been paid in his whole life. And now he had money. On the weekend, he'd given his mother money. He'd paid her rent. Wasn't he the luckiest person in the world to be able to pay rent? And he had money left over. Michael told us that he was really lucky because he worked with really nice people who were going to take good care of him and let him do all kinds of fun jobs. And then Michael began asking us if we had jobs. And one by one, the people all around him began to tell him where they worked and what they did. And Michael was full of enthusiasm for the various jobs that we all had. And he even managed to be excited when I told him that I was an accountant. He said, "You get to count things?" He said, "I'm really good at counting." He'd learned how when he was just a little boy. He liked counting. He thought that it would be great fun to be able to count things all day long. I must be the luckiest woman in the world. He said he was sometimes allowed to count the supplies in his new job. They had a cupboard where they kept pens and pencils. And when there wasn't anything else for him to do, they would let him count the pens and pencils. At some point on our journey, Michael began to speak about the weather. The dull, drab rain of Vancouver. Michael loved it. He told us how important the rain was and how wonderful it was that we got so much rain because our trees in Vancouver grow taller than any tree in all of Canada, probably in all the world. And our flowers, they love the rain. And there was so much food in the stores because the rain helped the vegetables to grow. And Michael's joy began to infect us. People smiled at one another. People began to speak and to respond to Michael's joy. And some of us, myself included, we waved at him when he got off at his stop. And he told us all to have a good day and that he was going to see us tomorrow. on that day and on every other day that I rode the bus with Michael, I was reminded, whether I wanted to be reminded or not, of the beauty and of the wonder of life. Somehow Michael managed to pierce our dullness. Somehow Michael was able to make us forget that his behavior was inappropriate, that he was intruding on us, that he was doing everything wrong, that he was breaking the rules. Michael burst into our lives and interrupted our routine, and in the middle of a dull, damp, and dreary February funk, he reminded us how truly blessed we really are. Well, here we are. Winter has finally arrived, and most of you know how I feel about snow, and there's probably 2 months of it lying ahead of us. We've had a lot of dull gray days that we're not used to around here, but we can be pretty sure that there's going to be 2 months of coping with the weather, of driving in the weather, of getting dressed in our boots and hats and coats. The holidays are gone, the celebrations are over, families have all gone home, kids are back at school, and most of us have managed to settle into the daily routines that make up our lives. We have hunkered down, and we'll find a way to get through the winter. We have things to do, people to see, and we must accomplish it all whilst dealing with the harsh realities of life. And in the midst of all this, it's my job to bring you the same good news that Michael brought to me and to my traveling companions. You see, today's gospel lesson gives us such a remarkable revelation about the nature of our Creator. So it's time for us to sit up and take notice of just how blessed we are. We've all heard the story of Jesus turning water into wine. We've marveled at it or speculated about Jesus, about whether he did or did not perform a miracle, whether it happened the way it's been written down. But the story of Jesus turning water into wine has very little to do with Jesus' ability to perform miracles. This is a story about the awesome, unimaginable, incredible grace of God. In this story, our God takes on flesh, and we get a glimpse of just who God is. According to this story, Jesus is the guest at the wedding. And the feast has been going on for a while, and people are slightly looped. There's no real need for more wine, except for the social rules and regulations that say you don't run out of wine while you have guests. Now, at most of the weddings that we've all been to, when the wine runs out or when the bar closes, it's no big deal. The party just winds down and we all go home. But at this particular party, Jesus' mother points out that there is no more wine, clearly expecting her son to do something about it. And Jesus hesitates at first because it's not his responsibility. And besides, the timing is all wrong. But his mother just carries on like Jesus hasn't said a word. And Mary instructs the servants to do whatever Jesus tells them to do, and so Jesus gives in. Now at that point, all Jesus had to do to satisfy his mother and the rest of the guests was to provide a little more wine. But instead, Jesus provides at least 150 gallons of wine. And not just any wine, but the best vintage. Now I ask you, when was the last time that you were at a party and when the wine ran out, the host provided not just a little more wine, but 150 gallons of the best wine? Now I don't believe for a moment that the point of this story is that Jesus could work miracles. In this story, Jesus shows us in a very dramatic way just what living in the reign of God is like. 150 gallons of the best wine for a group of people who have already been drinking is simply outrageous. But then, isn't that just like the creator of everything that is? Think about it. How would you demonstrate the wonder and the generosity of the one who is the source of all that is and all that ever shall be? Just look at the fruits of the earth. An apple would have been enough. It's a wonderful fruit. We would all be satisfied with apples. But that wasn't enough. The Creator fills the earth with fruit. Or look at the birds. Not just crows and sparrows, which are perfectly fine creatures, but look at the birds, the colors, the varieties, the flowers, the daisies, the daffodils, the snowflakes. None of it is subtle. It's all extravagant. The source of all being flowers the earth with roses and orchids and snapdragons. We just have to look around us to see the extravagantly generous nature of our Creator. The gifts of Jesus at the wedding feast went far beyond meeting the needs of the moment for the health or safety or nourishment of Jesus' friends. According to the story, the gifts of Jesus encompass the celebration of life itself. The sheer abundance of the gifts Christ brings to humankind extend beyond what any human being can ask or think or comprehend. Despite the fact that we are trapped in the routine of our lives, the nature of God which is revealed in Jesus the Christ ought to be more than enough to cause us to rejoice every day of our lives in celebration of life itself. We ought to be the ones who are as intoxicating as Michael was on that bus. And just as Christ has revealed our Creator's grace to us, Jesus is the one who calls us to be Christ's to one another. We have been blessed with a sheer abundance of gifts. God's generosity to us is beyond our comprehension, and we cannot be content to confine our charity to a discrete set of arbitrary rules that fit into the routine of our lives. The gospel, the good news, does not play by the rules. Some of us are barely learning how to share a cup of water with our neighbors when we should be breaking out a bottle of champagne to celebrate life together. Now, I know that it's not easy to celebrate life, but we ought to be able to at least share some of life together. In order to reflect the glory of our God, it's not enough for us to meet the needs of our neighbors. And I hear this all the time. Just give them enough to get by. Don't give them anything for the luxuries of life. They don't need a car. They can take the bus. We need to become extravagant in our loving. We need to find ways to celebrate life with one another. People's problems may not be our problems, and the timing may be all wrong, but the gospel does not play by the rules. The gospel refuses to be confined to our safe, routine lifestyles. We are called to follow Christ, and that means we are called to the kind of extravagant generosity that boggles the imagination. We are called to commit outrageous acts of kindness, inspired by the inconceivable grace of our God and drunk with the joy of life. We must use extravagant notions of generosity as our guide in order to achieve the will of our Creator, who takes the time to create not just apples, but passion fruit. Now that's good news. Amen.